Blog Talk Radio.
Last night I saw a lunar eclipse in the sky. Then something happened in my mind's eye. I saw you in a whole different light. Clearly, really, it's not that I want you to change. It's more that I want you to stay the same.
Oh, and I do want you to stay the same. I want you to stay right here with me for the next hour. I'm very selfish that way. My name is Bonnie D. Graham, a.k.a. Radio Red, and the red hair was blazing in the Rosh Hashanah sun today with the top down. It's a glorious day here in New York, and a shout-out to all of our friends and listeners and family of the Jewish persuasion, Lashana Tova, from my home and my family to yours, wishing you a sweet, happy, and especially a very, very healthy coming year. I think it's 5773. My card had it wrong. What can I tell you? There's a joke going around about I didn't change the date on my check from 5772 to 73 yet. I'll have to learn. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, happy, happy, healthy to everyone. So here we are. My show is called Read My Lips. And you know you can't exactly do that, so you're going to have to listen. I have some very, very special guests for you. I like to think my guests add so much value to me that I want to share them with you. I learn from them. They're very smart. They're very insightful. They've done amazing things in their lives, things I couldn't even dream of doing or being involved in, but I want to know more, so I bring them to you here on Read My Lips. We're supposed to have two guests today, but right now we only have one on the line. I'm going to tell you about him, and then I'm going to do my usual shout-out and the celebrity birthdays, and then we'll get down to it. My first guest as of right now is Vladimir Kanizhai. He's from Yugoslavia. I understand he speaks Serbo-Croatian. He'll tell me if that was pronounced correctly. He is an author. We're going to talk with him about his specialty, which is soul woundologist. Do you have soul wounds? Do you even know what those are? We might even talk about the definition of soul today. We're going to talk about emotions. Did you know there are only two basic emotions, according to Vladimir, my new best friend? Love and fear. We're going to talk about how people come into your life, the old saying, they come into your life to show you something about yourself. You're mad at them, you're annoyed with them, you love them, you hate them. They're showing you something that's a reflection of the state of who you are at that moment in time, or perhaps who you are historically. So Vladimir is going to help me understand that concept because I never really grasped it, and we're going to talk about love and fear and how to express your emotions. He's had a very tumultuous life. He's overcome a lot. More than most of you have, I am sure. You wouldn't want to go through what he went through as a child. So we'll talk to Vladimir in a few minutes. And my possible second half guest will be Michael Robin Collins, who's an astrologer, a raw food specialist, a Reiki master, all kinds of good things. And he overcame diabetes through a raw food diet. He didn't want to face the fact that he was eating badly and way overeating all of his life. There are documentaries online showing how his family was worried about him as his weight ballooned and the diabetes got worse and worse. He overcame it. We're going to talk to him about all kinds of things, about how words can change your life. So, Michael, Robin, Collins, if you're listening, I hope you call in because we'd love to have you on the second half of the show. Let me do my shout-outs before I introduce to you Vladimir in just a minute here. Well, it's September 17th. Happy Rosh Hashanah, as I said. We have some famous birthdays. How about Elvira? I will not sing the song. Elvira. Cassandra Elvira Peterson, actress born today in 1951. Woo-hoo, Lady in Black. Happy birthday. John Ritter, died too young, born in 1948, same year as moi. Ken Kesey, One Flew Over, you know what, The Cuckoo's Nest, born today, as was Dorothy Loudon, the actress. We're going way back in time. Anne Bancroft, whose original name was Anna Marie Italiano. How authentic is that? I don't know where she got Bancroft from. Roddy McDowell was born today. Jerry Colonna, I'm going way back in time. How about the Marriott Hotels? J. John Marriott was born in 1900 today. Special Rosh Hashanah greeting to Cousin Freddie's family. That's Cousin Jeff out in California and Aunt Millie and all the wonderful people there. And Cousin Freddie, R.I.P., we love you and miss you. Greetings to the Seattle Moose, Chicks, and Llamas. Uh-huh, yes, we know. And here are my shout-outs to my beautiful family, Lorna and Dune, Kaylee, happy generator, My big kahuna, smaller. My dancer, my most likely to succeed photographer, Pepper, and my editor, and wishing all of our friends again of the Jewish faith a happy, healthy, and sweet new year. No movies to report. We might have some next week. So let me introduce my very first and my only guest right now, Vladimir Kanajai. That name has poetry to it. Welcome, Vladimir. How are you today?
I'm awesome. How are you?
Well, I'm better now that I found out you're awesome. What makes you awesome? Tell me, how does somebody get to say I'm awesome and say it with conviction, Vladimir?
Mostly I live in a state of joy. You know how people try to find happiness from outside of themselves. And it came to me that, you know, joy is kind of like the roots of a tree and happiness are the branches from that tree. So no one can take my joy away. They can't take away my happiness because normally we look for happiness outside of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We go do something to make ourselves happy. We buy something to make ourselves happy. And for me, that's one of the greatest sufferings is looking for happiness outside of ourselves because it can be taken away that fast.
This
so if I buy whatever it is and I lose it, I'm then unhappy. But if I'm operating from a place of joy, I'm set. So that's where my awesomeness, I live in that state most of the time.
I like that. Go ahead.
I think we're born with pure joy. We're just coming to the world that way. And then some well-meaning caregivers, parents, whoever they were, told us that maybe, you know, we shouldn't be in a state of joy, that maybe we should... We shouldn't feel sad. We shouldn't feel angry. We shouldn't be complaining, you know, whatever it is. And then we start losing our ability to be intuitive and joyful. And my thing was I got it back. I wanted it back. I wanted to be in a state of peace.
So let's talk about the soul first, because you call yourself something I've never heard of before, a soul woundologist. So let me read a couple of definitions from my trusty Bible here, Wikipedia. I think a lot of people trust Wikipedia. I'm not sure why, but it seems to have a heck of a lot of information. So let me read some definitions of soul, and let's get into soul wounds, and then we're going to talk about your two books. One I have in the ebook format that's already here, and then the other one we'll talk about that's coming, and we'll talk about love and fear. So the soul, I'm reading from Wikipedia, the soul in many mythological, religious, philosophical, and psychological traditions is the incorporeal, in many conceptions, immortal essence of a person, living thing, or object. Now, I'm going to skip down a little bit to what we're really looking for. Soul can function as a synonym for spirit, so that's your spirit, mind, your psyche, or yourself. Okay, so consider soul in scientific works as a synonym for your mind. And I won't get into all of the religions and the philosophies and blah, blah, blah. But let's talk about soul. So what is a soul wound, Vladimir? How do you describe that? Is it your creation, that term, or is it something you are using that came from someone before you?
I'm thinking that, well, we have wounds, and a lot of people use the expression core wounds, right? You've heard of that expression.
Mm-hmm.
We have core wounds from childhood. And I'm saying that our soul actually gets wounded, and our soul, when it's wounded, is the pain and trauma at the deepest core level. So I think we come in as souls, and we're having a human experience. So we come in clean, and then we get, quote-unquote, messed with. So my soul, to me, is that deeper, deeper part of myself that gets wounded over time. And then slowly, we forget who we really are, that we're pure love, and we start operating from a place of fear. That's why I mentioned, for me, there are only two feelings, love and fear. So, for example, if I have bliss, joy, happiness, those kind of things, that's a love place. If I have bitterness, anger, rage, sadness, depression, that's from a place of fear. So, really, we can always cut back down to those basic two. And all those other feelings, emotions, emanate from those two basic ones.
Okay. Now, let's go to your origins, Vladimir. Let's go out. People really need to hear your story because you had a lot of damage happen to you or potential damage as a child. You had a very tumultuous and difficult physically, emotionally, spiritually challenging upbringing. Why don't you give us the abridged version of your life story so we don't spend too much time on it, but I know my listeners really need to understand who you are before they can understand why soul woundologist is something that suits you so well, Vladimir. So tell us your early beginnings, please.
Well, originally my parents escaped from Yugoslavia because it was a communist country. So there was basically no work for them, no food. So they literally escaped. They just walked across the Alps and got put into a prison camp and then a refugee camp in Austria. And they said they want to go to Australia. And they said, certainly. And instead they sent them to North America, which was Sure, whatever you say, refugee.
Okay,
so
right.
Then they left me behind. So I wasn't even age one yet. So then they have to buy the government, pay them money to get me out of Yugoslavia to get me to North America. So I met them when I was 4 years of age. And as soon as I got off the plane, we took a bus from one city back to my city that I was living in, that I was going to eventually live in, and I could tell right away these people were using me as a surrogate parent. So they started telling me all their grief, all their issues, instead of saying, wow, we missed you, or something like that. They started telling me all their problems and the grief they've lived through, and there I was listening right off the bat. So I became their confidant, their mother, their father, name it, psychologist, psychiatrist. So right from the get-go. And when I wasn't listening to their stories, which I thought I was listening, this is important for the people that are listening to us right now, we get confused between sympathy and empathy. So I was actually being empathetic. I was listening to them without taking on their stuff. And then one day, I'm about 4.5, 5 years old, my father hit me in the head and said to me, you're not listening.
Ouch.
And I'm like, I thought I was listening. And then he hits me again every time. I'm like, I know what it is. They want me to suffer. So I started going, oh. And then
Vladimir,
now
I want
listening.
You to stop. That's a lot for a 4.5, 5-year-old child to process. You barely
lot.
Have your own sense of self at 2, 2.5. You're barely forming. Your ego is still very roughly in formation. So you were expected to be a confidant, a psychologist, a sufferer, a listener of grown-ups. Who were your biological parents? How could that possibly be? What I can't imagine what was going through your head at the time. So you learned to suffer because they made you physically suffer. Is that correct?
And the reason I'm just going to do a segue here. That's what happens to most of us when we're children. We learn to sympathize versus empathize. So that means I'm going to carry your cross, so to speak. You know, you've heard, Christians say that. Jesus carrying the cross kind of story.
Right.
And that's what we do. We take on our people's stuff. That's not our stuff. So we learn later, we don't learn how to be empathetic and just go, I understand, and I'm not suffering for you. I'm detaching with love. I was doing that right off the bat. And then somehow they just, you're not listening. Once I suffered, the beatings about not listening stopped. But the beatings continued about other things. Like I have to, for example, my father would say, go tell me the time. I've never looked at a clock. I don't know what I mean. Go shy your shoes. Go ride that bicycle. Go mow that lawn. And I have to figure it out, like, on the spot. So in hindsight, when I look back, the person I am today has a lot to do with my father saying, you figure it out. You figure it out. You do it. It was abusive, of course. It could have been a gentler way, but that wasn't my program, obviously.
Yeah.
So then so mostly it was just a lot of beatings, and my mother got a lot of beatings. And what happened is she played this little game with me where she would protect me when I was little, grooming me so when I was older to protect her, and it worked, because as soon as I got big enough, I started protecting her from the beatings.
Wow. Did you emancipate yourself from the home at some point?
I left in the 10th grade, yeah.
Okay, all right. And where did you go? What happened?
So I guess what's missing is my brother was born when I was 5, and I, as I'm writing my personal life story, I realized it wasn't a few months I was with him, parenting him. He was born in March. I didn't go to school in September. I went to school the following September. So I walked around with that little boy for 1.5 years, being his father and mother while my parents were at work. And then when my dad came home, instead of coming home, he'd go to the bar. So I raised that little boy. A 5-year-old can raise a 1-year-old. Who said you can't? So I was his father and his mother. Yeah.
Yep. Survival. Yep. I hear survival. So for you, let's get personal now, Vladimir Kanige. Let's talk about what your original soul wound was. Was it the beating from your father? Was it the expectation you would be all grown up at 4 or 5 and be a compatriot or compadre or a listener to the family, a co-sufferer, codependent, if you will? What exactly was it that you describe as your soul wound?
Well, I had a number of them. So probably some of the wounds that formed, and I'm going to just say they form eventually, some of them that formed for me were probably insignificance, that I was an insignificant person. Stupidity was one of my soul wounds. I just got a list of them. I can't even begin to tell you how many that I had. It's just so many. And, of course, people come in when they see me, they come in with all kinds of soul wounds, and they'll actually tell me these are my soul wounds. I'll either tell them right off the bat, or I'll guide them to telling me what their soul wounds are.
Now, let's stop for a second. You say when people come in where? What is
it? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
to
come in the sessions with me. I actually do the soul woundology process, I have clients come in. I also have a group that I do. But typically, I work with clients one-on-one. So I have a list. Can I just give you a small list of what my clients have expressed to me as far as their soul wounds?
Yes, I'd love
Maybe
you to. But tell
help.
Me, do you have a degree in this? Are you a psychologist and master of social work, a therapist?
No.
How do you describe yourself professionally?
The way I learned to do this was, first of all, I was going to be a psychologist. So while I was a single parent raising two children, I was also a retirement and estate planner, at the same time taking my psychology degree through correspondence. And then it came to me one day, wait a minute, this is all about analysis. This isn't going to work. The answers have to come from somewhere deeper. And bam, I dropped psychology and I switched over. But I do have a psychology background, absolutely.
Okay.
So that does help a lot in my work.
Yeah.
But my big gift is that I see people's hidden feelings and I can identify their soul wounds. And I'm the only person I know of that has that gift so far. I'd love to meet someone else that has it. We'd have a great talk. But so far, I'm the only one that has that.
Interesting. So now take me through. You're going to share with us some of the things your clients or your what do you call them, clients, or what's the terminology?
Yeah, they're clients. I would call them clients, yeah.
Okay, and what is it that they present to you? What kinds of soul wounds do you see
in your
practice?
Here are some examples from their own. These are their own words. And I actually have it on my website listed literally under soul wounds. And so one person says they run redundancy. They're redundant. You know what I mean? That's a powerful
word.
No,
what's redundant?
I might not be redundant, you might not be, but this person saying, I am redundant. They have no value. They're redundant in the family. That's how they started off. So that's their soul wound that they carry to this day.
Okay.
Another one is self-loathing, unlovable, lost, insignificant, traumatized, average Joe, incomplete, sinner. So if you can imagine, I have my hands out in front of my stomach, and let's call that the core of ourselves.
Yes.
Every time I move, I look at you, I'm going to attract you into my life to be in a relationship with me. I am running my worthlessness or whatever it is. You're going to be worthless. I have to because that's my wound. I have no choice. The first employer I go to, let's say first job I get, I feel worthless. I'm going to be treated worthlessly at work. All the way through my life, all my friends are going to think I'm worthless. It's just steady, the same. When we heal that soul wound of worthlessness, who we attract also changes.
Interesting. Now let's use that as a segue. I have so many questions to ask you, and I am looking at your book. Your first book is How About I Just Be Me. I'm looking at the PDF, and thank you for sending that. We're going to talk about your new book later in the show, the one that's coming up soon. But talk to me, please, Vladimir, about, I used this in my opening. People have said to me for a long time that when somebody comes into your life, if they're annoying or it's a painful relationship or they're quote-unquote abusive, they're there for a reason, and they're reflecting something in you that's a lacking, or that's a hole in you, or that's something that's broken in you. So it's not enough to just say, he's such an annoying person, I want him out of my life. It's he's there to reflect something in you. He's pushing your buttons, if you will. Tell me how that works. I've asked many people, and nobody has been able to really successfully explain it where I grasp it, but I don't embrace it. So, Vladimir, can you help me with that?
Okay. So the crux of my soul woundology process is based on that. Remember I sent you that thing saying, fraternize with the enemy. They'll heal you.
Yes.
They'll literally save your life. So let's pick something. Let's pick betrayal. Let's say somebody constantly gets betrayed. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're blaming those other people. All those people are betraying me. They're betraying me. So what I get that person to do, that client, is I get them to associate with that person that betrays them constantly. I get them to go for lunch with them. I get them to go for tea, whatever it might be. And then we take them back to visit their past. So where was I betrayed when I was little? Me personally. Why did I witness betrayal with my parents, with their friends, with whoever? And then secondly, where do I betray others? Thirdly, when am I betraying myself? And that's where the powerful healing comes from. So that's it. Once I've healed the betrayer in me, then I can hang around with you if you're a betrayer, a traitor, let's call them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, but I have a choice. I can hang out with you, fully embrace that I'm a I'm also running betrayal, or I cannot talk to you anymore because that doesn't serve me anymore. But the difference is between the regular person and myself and my clients is we're embraced it. So if I embrace it, I also betray people. I have a choice to hang around with a traitor or not. If I haven't embraced it, the only choice I have is to get away from them because they make me sick. You know, in basic psychology, they taught me that. They say, you got a problem with someone, get away from them. I'm saying, hang out with them, hang out with them, hang out with them. And that's where the healing comes from. So eventually, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, interesting. I have a very close friend who has somebody in their extended family who really, I'll just come right at it, really pisses him off because he feels that this person who is significantly younger is just all about me, 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 all about himself. It's all about him. It's all about his reactions, his responses. And this person, my friend, just cannot stomach being around the other person, just feels that there's always an agenda, there's always a what can you do for me, and it really, really irks him. So he's decided not to be in the company of this person anymore. Now tell me, if I were to try to explain your theory or your process, let's say that way, Vladimir, how would I explain to my friend that by staying with this other person, he can see something about himself that needs to be healed, whether he chooses to heal it or not is another topic. So how would I explain that? Is this an example, a good example?
It's a good example. I guess I'm looking for an adjective maybe. Would he consider that person narcissistic or what would he what
yes,
word
totally
I use?
Narcissistic. Totally
okay,
narcissistic.
So, right. So if I have an issue with a narcissist, which I used to do, all these adjectives that I come up with, I ran a lot of these. So I remember not liking narcissistic people. So when I hung around with a particular narcissist that triggered me a lot, I saw where my parents were narcissistic. Obviously, just from a little bit you heard about my story, these were extreme narcissists. So that carries forward into my adult life. I despised them for that. I wanted them to say, Vlado, what about you? But they didn't. So then I became narcissistic with other people. But, of course, I don't want to do that, Bonnie, because I promised myself I'm never, never going to be like my parents. You heard this story enough times.
Of course.
I'm never going to be narcissistic like my parents are. But guess what? All of a sudden, I'm a narcissist in adult life. And then I'm narcissistic with myself all the time. I really think I'm something. That's my arrogance running, which means it's the flip side of shame. I'm so ashamed I'm arrogant. Because I can't be humble, I can't be grateful. All that is tied in. Now, you bug me so much, I know that it can't be you, because so what if you're narcissistic? So let's say 10 people agree he's narcissistic. So what? Why is it bothering me so much? That's where the peace will come from. I want to know where I'm that way. And once I heal that, oh my. And you know what else happens? Here's a miracle of miracles. That narcissist will change. He'll become altruistic just by me being accepting and embracing of my narcissism. They change. Tom, I don't know why it works that way. I work with hundreds of people. It always works the same way. That other person changes.
Interesting,
interesting.
So my friend would see that he's got some narcissistic qualities as well in him, and that's why the other person bothers him so much.
It's hard, though. It's very humbling to look at it. It's because, oh, my God, I'm like that, too.
He would never see that. He would. I see it as his friend, and I care for him, but he would never see that he's the same way. And I've said to other people he's that way. He would never see it in a million years. He would just say, this person makes everything about him, and that's all he would say.
In my world, I want to take full responsibility and accountability for everything I say and do and not blame anyone or anything, including myself. So in that world, I want to look at I don't want to blame that person anymore. I have had people that want to commit suicide. I was just telling someone today about a client example that he came in and he was so suicidal. He already had a gun in his mouth. He phoned me from some parking lot, 357 Magnum. But
oh
at the time
God.
We were done, he says, it's not the government. It's not my wife. It's not my boss. It's me. I don't have to kill myself. See, it's a completely different way of looking at it. So he's not blaming anyone anymore. Once we see it, we are all those things we hate in the others. We're free to live. We don't have to die. It wasn't the government. It wasn't his wife. It was him all along. That's why I'm calling that hard copy book that's coming, I'm the problem.
Right.
The problem.
So how did you keep him from pulling the trigger? What did you say to him that kept him from, once he realized this was him, he didn't feel shame and angst about his own shortcomings and didn't want to kill himself anyway?
Once he embraced those things that he accused his wife of and his boss of, there's no reason to die. Because nobody's out to get him. Nobody's out there. All those paranoid, schizophrenic things he had running, that was him. He doesn't have to die anymore because he saw things that weren't real. He was projecting. That's what I mentioned earlier. If we can go back to my childhood, yours, whoever it is, we all have parents that they were well-meaning parents. Look, I mean it. Every interaction is an act of love or a call for love. I can honestly tell you that my parents loved me. It's just they loved in that particular way. So the people that come to me, they say, I want to love differently. So I literally tell them, there's no dysfunctionality in your home. They go, what? I said, how do I know that? Your family functioned. You just want a different way to love. And they go, that's right, I just want to love differently. So, Bonnie, in my time, if you hit me with a frying pan, that was love. Now I want my face touched gently.
Mm-hmm.
So we literally can't change the way we love. I have an equation.
Yes, what's your equation?
I don't like equations, but this will help.
Yes, I do.
So if home equals love, which theoretically it's supposed to be, and home was, fill in the blank, abuse, disregard for me, whatever it is, then for me, love is that same thing. It's exactly the same as the way I was raised,
so
I decided to change it.
Right. So our early definition of home equals love equals however the expression of love. Very, very interesting.
We'll replicate it.
To grow up in a very loving and nurturing and caring home, a very protective home, and that's how I guess I interpret love, as nurturing and caring and protective and aware and observant and all
right.
those wonderful things. I guess I was very blessed. I know my mom is
listening
to the show, and my mom didn't come. Well, she came from a very a broken home because of so many illnesses and people living in different places and the war and all that. But
I think she
grew up with a great amount of love, I believe, from the people who cared for her. And she and my dad had an absolutely wonderful marriage, just wonderful marriage, and they conveyed that to me and my sister. So. We were very fortunate. Now, I want to move over to something else in your book. By the way, Michael Robin Collins has not called in. We're almost at the halfway point. So, boys and girls, ladies and gents, I'm going to continue with Vladimir, and we're going to talk more about his book, and we're going to talk more about something I need to tell everybody, Vladimir, is your one sheet. And anybody who doesn't know what a one sheet is, this is what people like Vladimir hand media, like myself, when I meet him at events, and I met him and many other of my wonderful guests at the National Publicity Summit in New York several months ago. And they hand me a one sheet that tells me what the theme of their talk would be, what they're all about, the title of their book, story idea. So I'm looking at his one sheet, and I'm going to read a little bit from this, Vladimir, just to give you a break here. He says, there are no magic pills or potions to eliminate problems, create success, alleviate trauma. And here's what he says, his position statement is, some things that in my professional experience absolutely do not work. Okay, kids who are listening, listen now, because this is important. These do not work. Number one, rehab, 12-step programs, acting powerful, we'll talk about that. Wealth and fame, okay. Speed grieving, I imagine that's accelerated grief processing. Forgiving them, okay. Minimizing, I guess that's making something smaller than it really seems to be in your life. Positivism, spiritual bypassing, those I don't know. Antidepressants, that's a powerful statement. We know we're a drug-based society, a culture. We know we live by our farms, don't we? PHARMS. Gratitude, that's a big one today, Vladimir. People say, give gratitude, you'll feel better, life will be wonderful. Diets, well, I guess that's one way of fixing life. And praying, you're really striking at the heart of everything most people know and believe in, Vladimir, when you say
right.
gratitude, praying, and diets and antidepressants don't work. I think you've just underpinned most of the whole pharmaceutical industry, the whole 12-step recovery industry, and everybody who's out there saying gratitude, gratitude, gratitude.
Right.
So how do you dare? I'm going to ask you point blank. How do you dare come across and say these don't work? What's your position?
Well, that's my experience with my clients. Typically, when they
okay.
come in, they have tried however many of those, and they haven't worked. And, you know, there's a program on TV where a famous doctor has a rehab program, and I can tell you that those people, they either die or they go back to rehab or they're back on where they were, because if the wound isn't healed, see, if I come out of whatever it is, whatever rehab program I'm in, and I was on drugs or alcohol or sex, whatever it was, even if I got rid of that, I'm going to replace it with something else. With my clients, they don't have to replace it. Nobody says we have to replace our addictions. That's soul psychology stuff. So that's why it sounds so counterintuitive, because it is. And the only thing that worked for me, like I think I mentioned, maybe I haven't, at age 39, I had 3 months left to live. I mean, there was nowhere for me to turn anymore. I was just down on my knees, literally. And I just got custody of my kids. I'm a single parent. I'm like, oh, no, what am I going to do? So nothing was working. So that's why I developed the soul woundology process.
Very interesting. Now tell me about gratitude. Why doesn't gratitude work? That's the buzzword of our times. Okay. Come on, Vladimir. Everybody. I'd say 30% of the authors I have on this show say it's all about gratitude. Have your gratitude statements every day. Think about how grateful you are for your blessings and all the good things in your life and the talents you have and the people around you. Why doesn't it work? Come on. Okay. You're tilting windmills here. This is the popular windmill of our day today. Give gratitude. It works. Come on. Talk to me.
So the reason it doesn't work is because if I'm still running, then I'm ashamed. The only thing I can do if I'm ashamed is when I'm covering up the shame, okay, because I can't walk around looking ashamed, what happens is I get arrogant. Now when I get arrogant, it triggers my shame. I go back to shame. Now I can write all the gratitude journals I want. There's a famous talk show host that writes 5 gratitude things a day in her book for 20 years now. Nothing's changed in her life. She's still struggling with the same issues. And that's because she's still ashamed. So when we get to a place of true gratitude, we can then, the flip side of gratitude is humility. I haven't met anybody that's in a shame-based place that's actually grateful and humble. Technically, they can write them out, but nothing will change. How can it? How can I be grateful if I'm ashamed? I'm ashamed. That's my wound. I'm ashamed. How can I be grateful for anything that shows up in my life? And as soon as it does, Bonnie, let's say it does show up in my life. I don't deserve it. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
I'm ashamed.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm a piece of... Oh, a family show? I'm a piece of doo-doo, and I always will be.
That's true. Now, let me go to another one of the talking points here. Let's get into some fun stuff here and before we go to another part of your book about the expressions of I feel, and I really want to dig deep into that. But let's do something fun here, Vladimir, since you're my guest for the whole hour. I haven't interviewed one guest for the entire show in a long time, so tag, you're it, and I appreciate this very much. So are people's relationships breaking down because of a myth? You're going to debunk 6 myths about men and women. So go ahead, Vladimir.
Do you want to hear them all, or do you want to one at a time break them down, or what would you like to do?
I want to hear them. I want to hear each one with a little discussion, a little explanation of each of the 6. So tell me the myth, and tell me how you debunk it, and then I'll ask you some questions.
Okay. So remember, these are in my professional experience with hundreds of clients. That's where this comes from.
Yes.
So in my professional experience, men are way more emotional than women. Now there's a myth
that's the myth, or that's the truth?
I'm saying the myth is that women are more emotional than men.
Yes.
And I'm saying in my professional experience, men are way more emotional than women. They get to their hearts much quicker. I don't have to drag it out and drag it out like I do with the women. They're so much more open to going to their hearts. And that's a big myth that, you know, that's what I meant about relationships end because of it. Sometimes they're not even formed because of it. That's a big myth. They are not more emotional. Yeah. That's my
thing. Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yep.
100% of my
females. Did you see the
movie?
Did you see the movie Hope Springs?
I don't think so.
Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones. You have to see it.
I know of it.
You just said.
I know of it.
Go see it.
Okay.
Go see it.
Thank you.
Okay. So what's the second myth debunked?
100% of my female clients have had affairs on their significant others. Only 30% of my male clients have affairs. And the common theme that you hear is men think with their penises. No.
Okay, talk to
now,
me.
The reason women tell me the truth. Sorry.
Let's do some demographics now. Is there an age range for this? Is there an education range for this? What is it?
No. Every one of my female clients, every one of them has had affairs. Now the reason they tell me is because of the embracing I've done on my own issues. I don't judge them for anything they say or do. So they will absolutely tell me the truth. They told me even on surveys they lie. They even lie when they're being surveyed and nobody's watching because they're so ashamed of doing it. But yet the whole program is running, hey, men are the pigs. Really? I'm not saying either one is pigs. I'm just telling you what the world says. Men think with their penises. Really, do they? In my experience, men think with their hearts.
Very interesting. So what's myth number 2? I'm enjoying this.
That was two. Number one was 3. Emotional. Number 2 is
100%
of my female clients have affairs.
Right. What's number 3?
Men are intimidated by successful women. That's a myth.
Yes.
Not in my experience. That's a story that women make up when they cannot explain why they push men away. That's my experience. Mm. And once we, especially, you know, when it really comes out, Bonnie, is in the groups, when I have the men and the women together in a large group, and it's all discussed, and all these women make up a story, and that one guy will say to a woman, no, why don't you just show me your heart? Why don't you stop yapping to me about what a great lawyer you are and a great accountant or a great engineer? Why don't you show me your heart? I would love that. That's what my men say. So, but women make up this story. Oh, I can't attract the guy because I'm so successful. The guy's so scared. No, he's not. No, he's not scared. Show him your heart. Like the old days, Bonnie. Old school. Show me your true self. Show me your soul.
You're really going to the heart of the myths here, Vladimir. Okay, what's myth number four?
Women listen better than men. Not even close. Yes. In my professional experience, men are far superior in their listening skills. Now, that's a big one, isn't it?
That's huge.
Hey?
Talk to me. Tell me more about that. Well, how do you know this? I know you say from your clients, but how do you know that men have superior listening skills?
Again,
what are they listening for?
These are just simply my experiences of the hundreds of people I've worked with, right? So, and obviously it means something. That if I'm experiencing it, then it must be out there. And again, I'm part of the drawing card. They are able to do whatever they need to do because, can I just do a segue to something? Here's my definition of how I love. You can be, say, or do anything you want without judgment or retribution, and there's nothing you can say or do that I would love you less.
Ouch. Wow. Say that again. I want to hear that again.
That's why they tell me everything. You can be, say, or do anything you want without judgment or retribution, and there's nothing you can say or do that I would love you less.
And you say this to your clients, or you tell them
that's how I love. That's how I love everyone. Now, if you trigger me, I'll fully say, okay, I'm being triggered. That's my issue. It's not about you. And I rarely get triggered now because of the wound healing that I've done. I hope that I practice what I preach. I make sure I do that.
Well, that would be very, very important for your clients. By the way, where are you based now? You're in Canada.
I'm in Edmonton, Canada, yes.
Okay, let's talk about, are we up to myth number five?
Okay. Women are better multitaskers than men. Again, not in my experience.
I'm going to fight you on that one. If you don't agree on that one, I'm
going
to fight you on that one.
I thought you would.
Absolutely.
Bonnie, you got to remember who's experience. I'm only talking about my experience.
Right.
So I used to be in my previous business life where I was the retirement estate planning. I was also a district manager with the Prudential of America, believe it or not. You know the Prudential.
Yeah.
So they were also up here. And in my experience, again, my male advisors were better at multitasking than the females. What the females were good at, once they, again, the attraction, right? They were, my female representatives were better producers than the men. How's that?
Interesting.
Isn't it?
Better producers.
They produced more business than the men did.
Interesting,
yeah,
but the men were better multitaskers.
The reason they did better is because they were able to focus. The men were multitasking. So you see what I'm saying? I'm not a good multitasker anymore. I can only do one thing at a time. But I used to be able to study for my Chartered Life Underwriters exam, watch the NBA, play with my kids, read a novel, listen to the radio. I could do it all.
I'll tell you my new definition of multitasking. I do a business radio show for a very large company where I'm a senior marketing manager, and I do this show interviewing some of the world's top business thought leaders, you know, consultants, analysts, people who are senior in their companies, who are authors, professors, a panel of three or four. While I'm on the show, I've got three computer screens going. I've got a Mac and a PC. I have a headset on that crushes my ears. I'm on a Skype chat with my engineer who is in Phoenix, Arizona, checking on the sound quality of all of my guests, and he's telling me when to go to break, and I'm telling him I need more time, and we're negotiating the length of the breaks before they happen, talking to the three or four guests, looking at the guest pre-quotes, at talking points, 5 to 10 talking points, which are not just bullets but sometimes paragraphs for all of the guests, all of their bios. Plus, I'm live on Twitter retweeting all the tweets during the show, and I'm communicating on instant message with two of my colleagues on the third screen while hosting a live radio show for 1 hour twice a week. Now, is that multitasking or what?
No kidding.
No kidding.
I bow down to you. Okay, so much of my myth debunking. No, I'm just playing.
What can I tell you?
No, you're awesome.
That is my new definition of multitasking.
So
anyway,
let me share this with you. I'm not able to multitask anymore. Right now, I'm with you. I don't do anything else other than be completely present with you. That's what I've gotten good at. So I take all my multitaskers, male or female, and I get them to do one thing at a time. And their lives improve tremendously. But I understand in your situation, it's pretty
sometimes
tough to do one thing at a time.
You have to make it a rich experience. But I am doing nothing other than pay attention to you and the switchboard and looking at your one sheet and drinking an occasional sip of water and watching for email to see if Michael emails in. So it's very limited multitasking now. So we're up to five. These are fascinating, fascinating, Vladimir. I'm just delighted with what you're saying because I know my listeners are probably saying, huh, what?
Yeah.
Is he kidding? And that's getting them to reflect on their own experiences. Maybe they will look a little more gently or a little more generously at these gender stereotypes the next time they're in a situation. So let's go to the big finish number six. Myth number six. According to Vladimir Kanjai, what is myth number six?
All right. Well, I've got a number more of them, but this particular one, I think would people will understand this. Women claim they don't achieve orgasms because men do not know how to please them sexually. Now, again, in my professional experience, it's the woman's lack of intimacy that keeps her from having orgasms. They're so scared to let go. That's what I meant about the men get to their feelings quicker, to their emotions, to their soul. With women, it's such a tough time. When they finally let go, though, they really have an orgasm. It had nothing to do with their guy. Never did. Because it can't be a coincidence that every time they release their soul wounds, right, and they become trusting in that they've made the right choice in picking that individual to be with them, they all orgasm. What a coincidence. I think not. But that's what they say. Again, it's just like when they say, well, I can't attract men because I intimidate them because of my professionalism and I'm successful. Same thing here. They blame the man. But remember, in my world, it's always about me. It's me. So you know how you hear the expression, oh, you turn me on, baby. In my world, it's, I allow you to turn me on, baby.
Yes. By the way, I'm going to do a little shocker here. Somebody gave me the book, 50 Shades of Grey, 3 days ago as a gift. I was finally ready to read it, but really didn't know what I was getting into. This gift arrived, and I was shocked because I didn't know the person knew I really wanted to read it after all this talk about it. I am reading it. I read 200 pages. Have you read it yet?
No, I haven't. No,
you
no
really
but
might.
I heard.
You want to. It's darker than I thought. It's a very difficult read. It's
really?
Not a fun topic. Yeah, it's a much darker, more involved story than I ever anticipated. What I'm reading now, I'm up to page 200, and it's not anything near what I expected, but it's a fascinating story of power. That shall just be all I will say. But I strongly suggest, in addition to seeing the movie Hope Springs, that you, my friend, Vladimir Kanjai.
So I've got a movie I got to see and a book I want to get. Okay.
Read the damn book because it will help you understand, I think, a lot, help you in your practice, or it probably is something your female clients would like to talk to you about. And you have to read it. Just the first book. That's all. I'm not going to.
I've got
past
a pretty good
book.
Idea what it's about. I've got a pretty good idea because I still keep my finger on the pulse on what's going on in the world. Of course, obviously, you know a lot more about it because you've read it already, so.
Only 200 pages, but it's getting to be a tough read. It's a lot of. I just can't believe it's as popular as it is.
What are you struggling with? Like, where is the difficulty?
The difficulty is the actual subject matter of the relationship. It's a dark relationship. It's something most people would never ever contemplate, be confronted with, be asked to participate in, or in which to participate. So it's a decision making process. It's something that is foreign to how most of us conduct our lives. It's almost a cultish kind of a thing, and I won't say any more.
All right.
Very different than what I expected, but it's interesting. It's very interesting. I will read the whole thing, but I suggest you read it because I think before the movie comes out. Anyway, so we did the six myths. Now, you need to help me with something here from your book, How About I Just Be Me. You're talking about, we're going to talk about feelings. We're talking about love and fear, the only two true emotions, if I have that correct.
Right.
And people talk about how they respond to people in their lives. So let me read some statements from your book. I'm just on page six here. And you say, I feel that you are a jerk.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm not being heard. You make me feel angry. You make me feel like an idiot. I feel like you're attacking me. And you, Vladimir Kanjai, I say these are not feeling statements. These are thoughts, not feelings. These are, I will go as far, Vladimir, to say that these to me are observations, but they're not feeling statements. So let's dissect a couple of these in the time we have left. Let's go with, you make me feel angry. Why is that not a feeling statement, Vladimir?
Because it sounds like I'm a victim of something. So if I say I feel angry when you blah, 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 that's more personal and taking full responsibility again, full responsibility and accountability for my feelings. Nobody's telling you there's anything wrong with your feeling, but when I say to you, Bonnie, you make me feel so angry. It's impossible for you to make me feel angry. I can say to you, you know, when you reject me, when I come in the door and I want a hug from you and you don't give me one, I feel rejected and I feel angry. You hear the difference? Versus, you make me really angry when you don't hug me. That's not true.
Right.
That's not true. See, that's what I mean.
So
it's a statement.
Is this a qualitative difference in saying, people would say, oh, what's the difference? You make me feel angry. I feel angry when you don't hug me. I mean, is that really a big deal? I'm just challenging you here. Is that a big deal in how people? It is. Okay.
It's the difference. There's no victim statement when I say to you, I feel angry when you don't hug me, because that is the cleanest thing I can say to you. I work, the very first thing I do with couples communications, I tell them, here's the number one thing you can say to your partner. I feel blank when you blank. And that other person doesn't even get hurt by it, because instead of saying, you're a jerk, you make me feel blah, 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 listen to how clean that is, Bonnie. I feel sad when you don't, whatever it might be.
Okay. And isn't this the basis of transactional therapy, I feel statements, rather than accusations or
descriptions?
Oh, could
be. That could be my old psychology stuff sneaking in.
I think it is. So instead
cool
of saying to someone, you make me – so let's dissect these a little bit further. You have an exercise here that I found very interesting. Let's go through the exercise. So you ask, how do you feel about thinking that I don't like you? And the person will say, I feel if I call you, you won't answer the phone. So that would be the expression of how they don't like you. And then you ask them, how do you feel when you're thinking that I won't answer the phone? And they would say, I feel you are talking behind my back. That's an interesting one. You ask, how do you feel about thinking I'm talking behind your back?
Right.
I feel you reject me. Then I ask, how do you feel about thinking I reject you? And the next statement is, I feel that I have failed. So you're taking them down a path of taking responsibility for their own feelings. And you say, how do you feel about thinking that you failed? And the answer is, I feel like I'm a loser.
Right.
How do you feel when you think you're a loser? I feel you won't love me. How does it feel when you think I won't love you? I feel bad. How does bad feel like? Not good. What does that mean? I don't know. When you don't know, what does that feel like? I don't know. Yes, you do. No, I don't. How? What if you did know? I feel useless, incompetent. And then
there
you got
go.
To the basis.
Finally. Yeah, and that's what the purpose of the exercise is. We could just do that right off the bat. But with couples, seriously, when they come in, it's like a grind. They're like, they throw this stuff out at each other and they throw it out. It's not a feeling. And as soon as they say those magic words, I don't care how, quote unquote, dysfunctional the relationship is. Remember, there's no dysfunctionality. I'm just going to use that for five sensory expression. When the person says, I feel blank, when you blank, the other person listens like that. It's automatic. It works for everybody because you can't discount how I feel. And if a person does try it, the person says, are you discounting how I'm feeling? That's how I feel. You can't change that. Bang on. Or, you know, let's say I experience you being a certain way. It seems to me like you're treating me badly today, like rejecting me, whatever it is. I'm not rejecting you. And you say, you know, that's how I experience you. I experience you rejecting me right now. And then the person listens because it's real. And when you reject me, I feel blank, whatever that is, whatever the feeling that goes along with it. But that's our biggest struggle.
Let's talk about Appendix 1, emotions emanating from love and soul versus emotions emanating from fear and ego. Can you describe the difference in the two lists, and then we'll give some examples, please?
I guess the big thing for when something comes from a place of love, it's always clean, it's gentle, it's calming, it's blissful. So as soon as it's not, we can tell. It's like, as soon as I feel jealousy, for example, that's not from a place of love, right? You can just feel it. It feels different in your heart. I can literally feel if I'm out of alignment when I'm not operating from a place of love. I think in some of the stuff I sent you there about, I met a guy a few years ago when I was near death and I couldn't see my way out, And he works with people in a hospice, thousands of people on their deathbeds. And you know what the two things they all say on their deathbeds?
No.
Thousands of people. Now, there's variations of it, but why don't you take
yes,
a guess?
What do they say?
What are the two things they say? Give it a shot.
I don't know.
Okay.
No, I have no idea. Talk to me.
They say, am I loved and did I love well?
Mm.
Not, I wonder how the office is going. I wonder if anybody shined up my car. I wonder if, do I have my squash date this afternoon? No.
I would even try, now that you've given me a clue, I would say something like, did I make a difference? Was I appreciated? Did I impact people's lives? That to me would be my, instead of was I loved, did I help anybody? Did I do anything good?
Right, so what I started to do when I heard that, somehow it just like a lightning bolt struck me. And I said, you know what? I'm going to look at this every day. So at the end of every day, I said, well, the operating, am I loved and did I love well? And eventually all I said was, am I loving today? It doesn't matter if anyone loves me. Am I being loving? And now I can tell moment to moment. If even for a moment, Bonnie, I went to a place of fear with you, I would have recognized it immediately. So the whole time we've been talking, I've been in a state of love with you. And that's what I get.
And anybody listening doesn't mean Vladimir's in love with me. It just means he's coming from a place of love. I just want everybody to know we're not starting anything here. I know Laura's listening. Laura, keep it down on the farm there, kid. Let's talk about the emotions emanating from fear and ego. I'm going to read a couple of them in the A list, if I may. A sense of loss, feeling abnormal, abandoned, abrasive, abrupt, absorbed, abused, abysmal, accused. Accused. How do we feel when people accuse us of things, Vladimir? What does that say? If somebody accuses you, you lied or you're not telling me the truth, they come right out and say it on something very trivial. How do you respond to that? Where is that coming from? Is that their fear? Is that their love? Where is it coming from?
Well, if they're hammering me, I know something, someplace along the line. Like, let's say, for example, someone comes in the door from work and I'm already having dinner or whatever, and they come in and they blame something on me. I didn't do anything. I'm simply having dinner. So I could tell them I feel accused when you hammer me like that. And that's a feeling. That's a legitimate feeling. I feel accused. And then they can say, oh, I didn't mean to accuse you, or no, it's not about you. Something happened at work. Somebody pooped in my cornflakes, you know, something like that.
Or I feel attacked. Now, what do you say back to them to get, do you want them to back off? Do you want them to reconsider? Do you want them to realize they're coming from their own place of insecurity and it may have nothing to do with you?
Again, it depends on, so for example, if I have a couple that's working on this together, then they have the green light to tell each other, what's that about you? What's that about you? So in the relationship work that I do with people, it's when they both give each other the green light, then they can say, you know, you're accusing me of this. I feel accused, yet I haven't done anything. What's that about you? Bam, it goes right back to that person.
Got it. That was the statement I was looking for.
I know what it is.
What's that about you? Now, I have a premise I've expressed many times on the show. I've been doing talk radio for, I don't know, 15, 16 years now. And this comes up in a theme I find with a lot of, and pardon the expression, self-help approaches or books. And I think that's what we're talking about, is how do we help ourselves become enlightened or become more open or become more self-knowledgeable or more loving, however you want to phrase it, Vladimir. And my premise is that the person who reads the book or takes the class or goes to the session or goes through the therapy or goes through the program is the one in the relationship who has become the one with more knowledge, perhaps more enlightenment, perhaps more tools to make the relationship better. Now, don't they end up having to be the one who does all the work, and the unenlightened, unknowledgeable, unstudied partner is still going to be coming from the place where they always have and might not appreciate that? So I see sometimes that enlightenment, without both parties taking part in it, Vladimir, ends up with an imbalance that could be even worse, because one knows more and feels maybe powerful and enlightened and more capable of working on the relationship, but the other one's still stuck where they always were. So how do you deal with that when you have couples? One is reluctant, the other one is eager. How do you deal with that in your practice, Vladimir?
Okay. So probably out of all the couples I've worked with, 50% come in together, 50% only one person comes in.
Yes,
and
those are the
what?
Ones I'm talking about.
It still works, because it only takes one person to make a relationship work. So if I'm doing the work and you're not, remember, you just have to be exactly as you are. That person that's at home doing nothing is so excited and so happy that he or she can be anything they want, because it's my issue. So that person that I'm working with says to that person, I'm really sad when you don't make supper for me like you promised. you know, the woman says to the guy, for example.
Right.
And then the guy goes, well, you know, I didn't make supper. I didn't keep my promise. And she goes, but that's about me. You don't have to change. Just keep on not keeping your promises. Please don't change anything. And that's the work. The other person in the relationship has to do nothing except be themselves. You know how freeing that is? It's awesome.
No. Tell me. Explain to me. I'm going to be really devil's advocate here. How is that freeing if I go home and say to my spouse, I'm sad you didn't make dinner. You promised. You know I'm working late 3 nights a week, and our deal was that you would make dinner for me, and you didn't make dinner, and now there's no dinner on the table. How does saying I'm sad because you didn't make dinner, or I'm disappointed you didn't honor our agreement, or our, how does that free the person who's still going to be hungry and still has no dinner that night when she comes home?
The freeing is the person that's not doing the work. The freeing to the person that didn't keep his promise, the one that never keeps his promises, that's freeing. They're saying, so the woman, was in this case, it was the woman says to the man, just keep on breaking your promises because that's something about me. I got to find out where I keep breaking my promises to you and my family and to others and to myself. And that's the work. But imagine the freedom for the unenlightened one, as we called it earlier.
Yes.
He don't have to do anything. He doesn't ever have to worry about making supper, keeping his promises again. The pressure he had on him before, she kept nattering and nattering. You got to keep your promises. You
got
to keep.
Got it.
He's like, I don't keep my promises. Put it on your fridge. That's what Jim does. See, that's the part of the work. We just put it on our fridge. That's what so and so does. What's that about me?
Okay. So in other words, she has to make other arrangements now for dinner on those nights, and he has no intention of cooking, so why keep that as a point of contention in the relationship?
He never has kept his promises. She's finally figured it out. She comes back to session next week, goes, guess what? Jim didn't make supper again. I go, I know. What did you tell me? Because you need to find out.
Surprise,
I know
surprise.
What Jim does.
Okay.
See, I already accepted that Jim doesn't make supper. She's still fighting. What's she fighting? She's fighting reality. One of the biggest insanities we have.
Thank you. Thank you.
Go ahead.
No, you're right. I'm saying thank you because you're right. She's fighting the reality that Jim has no intention. He might have bought into a contract or a promise he knew he couldn't keep. Maybe the pressure of the contract and the promise is really pissing him off. He's mad at her because she's late. He wants dinner on the table.
Oh,
they have to make another relationship. So by her releasing him, she's saying, we better figure this out a different way so we can both be happier.
And she's not saying we. She's saying, I will figure out a different way. I will. You
got
don't have
it.
To do anything, Jim. You just be Jim. Please.
Isn't she going to be mad at Jim, though? Isn't she going to be pissed that he couldn't keep his promise?
Not anymore. Not when we think.
Not
when she figures out where she breaks her promises. And guess what happens? When she heals that, Jim starts making dinners for no reason.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, kudos to Jim. I want to know what's on the menu. It's almost time for us to wrap up. I'm sorry Michael didn't call in, but, hey, you and I had a lot of fun. I'm talking to Vladimir Kanizhai, and his new book coming up is I'm the Problem? Vladimir, tell me, the website you'd like people to go to is thesoulwoundologist.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's right. The Soul Woundologist is all one word. Yeah. The Soul
Woundologist. I'm going to spell that for everybody. The T-H-E. Soul,
yeah.
S-O-U-L, wound, W-O-U-N-D, ologist, O-L-O-G-I-S-T, the soul, S-O-U-L, woundologist, very easy like psychologist, .com. You see a picture of the very handsome Vladimir Kanizhai.
Well, thank
like
you.
That. You're welcome. And
thank
how
you.
About I Just Be Me? Where can people find your book?
If you go to my website, to the contact services section, it says contact slash services.
I'm there.
You could basically just buy it through Amazon, through my website link. And then what I ask people to do is when the upcoming book, I'm the Problem, comes out, if they can leave me their contact information that I won't share with anyone, it just be between me and them. When the book comes out, then I will let them know when the hardcover book comes out. And any other questions or any suggestions they have, I'd love to hear from them.
Good, and I'm going to give you 30 seconds to tell me what's coming up next for you, and then we're going to do our big close. So what's next for you, Vladimir?
I guess the big thing for me, Bonnie, is that I don't want to come from a place of ego. My whole purpose in life is to shift the consciousness of the planet somehow, and I think this will do it. If everybody gets it's always about me, wars can literally end. And I can only do so many sessions one-on-one, so by doing these books, I know I can reach and touch a lot more people.
I love it. Vladimir Kanizhai, you've been a good sport. You've been a good guest. I've thoroughly enjoyed. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. And you and I are going to take a big deep breath and send out a message to everybody for some soul-wounding healing. Let's do that right now. Let's go moi, and we'll see how far we can take this. So you ready?
Okay.
Here we go. Take
yeah.
a deep breath. Oh, you outlasted me. There's a big kiss that's going to heal all the wounded souls. I'm Bonnie D. Graham, a.k.a. Radio Red. Vladimir, you're a trooper. You're a champ in my book. I wish you a great year. Stay in touch, and maybe we'll do this again. Everybody,
That would be wonderful.
Thank you, darling. To our friends of the Jewish faith, go visit thesoulwoundologist.com, and I'm at BonnieTV.com. Love you all. Mom, I adore you. Great to see you for the holiday, and everybody, we'll see you right here next week on Read My Lips. Bye-bye. Mwah. Have a great week.